Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
Now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Indian food. I like Mexican food. I love, it's hard to pick one. No, if I pick one favorite fruit, it's French fries. Okay? It's French fries. I can't stop eating them. But eat your vegetables. And
see,
exercise.
It's a joke, though. I had enough of this. This is the first lady. You listen to the whistles in the background and the chanting. Michelle Obama's goodwill tour of Africa to cost U.S. taxpayers about $800,000. $800,000. She took her mother, her daughters, her nieces. $800,000, Air Force Two. Now, what if Laura Bush had traveled to, let us say, I don't know, Ireland, England, and took an entourage of 40 personal assistants, bodyguards, daughters, nieces, and her mother? And it cost $800,000 at a time like this. Do you think there'd be an outcry in the media? Do I have to finish the sentence? Do I have to feign indignation to have you understand how unrighteous this first lady actually is? Are any of you as sick of this couple as I am? Forget about their policies. Let's put aside their radical Marxist policies for a moment. Let's just put that aside. Let us talk about how they've trashed and debased the presidency and the White House. Does that resonate with you, or am I being overly harsh? $12,723 per hour for the use of a C-32 plane, the same model as the one Mrs. Obama was ferried about on during her trip. That's in Africa, by the way. In Africa, that's not Air Force Two. They needed a military cargo plane to go with the First Lady on foreign trips in order to bring cars and other large items to the country. In other words, for her shopping bag, her cargo. They take a cargo plane to Africa. So the Queen of the May may have a good time eating French fries and other fried fritters. Mrs. Obama said the trip would help youth leadership, education, health, and wellness in Southern Africa, according to the White House. If Mrs. Obama had been accompanied by a military plane, it could easily add another $200,000 to the cost based on Defense Department rates. Mrs. Obama's office did not respond to the blog's request for comment. Now, the only one reporting on this is a British newspaper, Mail Online. Not to be seen in the New York Times or any of the other worthless rags here in the United States of America who continue to cover for this incredible, incredible debasement of the White House. Is this the most important story? I don't know. I really don't know if it's the most important story to talk about the debasement of the White House by Michelle and Barack Obama, but it's certainly worth talking about. I mean, we are concerned about an economy that is probably more destitute than that of Greece. It is certainly worth talking about a policy machine that is more corrupt than that of Blagojevich. And so therefore, I think it's worth talking about the corruption of Michelle Obama's fake goodwill tour to Africa. Now, on the same note of do as I do, not as I say, eat carrots while I'll eat French fries, we have Al Gore with his next crusade. The prophet of doom now wants everybody to save the planet by halting population growth. The looniest ex-vice president in American history, who's already made a fortune by scaring you into the imaginary boogeyman of man-made climate change, is now trying to get everybody to save the planet by halting population growth. I remember this bugaboo back from ZPG days back in the 60s. In fact, I knew somebody who was a proponent of ZPG. He committed suicide after having his tubes tied. About a year later, after cutting his vas deferens, he cut his own throat. because fundamentally anybody who cuts their vast deference, Obama, I mean, Al Gore's next crusade is stop having children. Why doesn't he say that to China or to India or to Brazil or to South Africa? Why does he tell you that? Why does a guy from Nashville tell you to cut out having children? While he himself apparently was in some ways like a crazed sex poodle in his shenanigans with masseuses. If you remember correctly, Al Gore was chasing a masseuse, according to her, around the massage parlor. And she called him, he looked like, she said he sounded like a crazed sex poodle. Now, here's a man who's apparently accused of being a crazed sex poodle by a masseuse, and then divorced by his wife, is now telling you to have less kids, to not have any sex. Listen to this and see if you agree with me or not.
He wrapped me in an inescapable embrace as I turned around, giving this come hither look deep into my eyes and caressed my back and buttocks and breasts. I squirmed to try and get out of his grasp, telling him to stop, down several times, and I finally told him and said, you're being a crazed sex poodle.
So the crazed sex poodle, Al Gore, is now telling you to limit your sex. How about this from the first couple? Stretched limousine numbers for Obama. This comes out from Fox News. The federal limousine fleet from these Marxists in the White House has increased by 73% during the first 2 years of the Obama administration. Write that down for your dinner conversation. Michelle Obama, who has debased the White House with her stupid speech about not eating fat while saying she loves French fries and the other idiocies that she has imposed upon us, let alone her imperiousness, and her travels. The federal limousine fleet under Obama has increased by 73% during the first 2 years of the Marxist Obama administration. The number of limos has increased from 238 in fiscal year 2008 to 412 limousines in 2010. The Marxist administration attributes the increase in limos to security concerns, but that's a lie. One watchdog group says, if the government can't track limos, I'm not sure we should trust the numbers they put out there on anything. Unbelievable to me. This is unbelievable to me, the number of limos. Now, I'm not going to get mad. I'm not going to blow up with righteous indignation over this. After all, I am the network. I don't have to feign an attack in a park or say that I have temporary hysterical blindness or hysterical deafness or whatever it is that some individuals use to continue their fake crusades and bringing you over to a paid pay-per-view. I really wish him the best of luck, incidentally. I do wish Hemorrhoid Dan the best of luck because he will pave the way for many other individuals who cannot get a radio show. They can have their own web-based show. But my prediction is, if you want to talk about that, that very few of the Mormons who are the predominant audience of Glenn Beck will pay $4.99 a month or whatever it is to watch him talk about his hemorrhoids on the web. I frankly do not think that the Mormon Church would recommend to its members that they subscribe to the Glenn Beck Hour. I really don't know how the church operates, but please don't accuse me of being an anti-Mormon because I'm the strongest supporter of religion. And in particular, I've defended the Mormons. I just don't like the fact that this hustler has used the Mormon Church to get where he is. This is the Savage Nation. The phone number is 1-800-449-8255. I'm an equal opportunity basher. From Michelle Obama to Mr. Blackboard, I'll be right back.
I put 120% to everything I do, even if it's washing my socks.
Don't you just love how she plays the down-home girl? She puts 120% into everything that she does, even if it's washing my socks. Who does she think she's fooling? Well, look, I don't watch Oprah Winfrey. I never did. I understand she's very famous and very successful. But I would think that Michelle Obama's core audience are the Oprah Winfrey watchers. I cannot imagine anybody listening to this show would be a fan of Michelle Obama, especially her $800,000 to $1 million trip to Africa for no reason other than to eat French fries and to teach the children about the culture of some kind. Let's take the calls. I mean, it's not the biggest thing on earth. I understand that. There are bigger problems. But it is summertime. And short of telling you about my childhood stories, which I really don't want to do, do you really want to hear them? Usually in the summer, I entertain the crowd. It's June 28th already, 2011. Did you ever think we'd survive 2 years of Barack and Michelle Obama? We've survived 2 years of them. We've survived 2 years of the two biggest phonies in the history of the presidency, which is not bad. But it's just starting. You got to understand. Look what Bush did in the last 3 months of his administration. Remember I warned you in October of that year that Bush was still there, that he still had 3 big months left, and he broke the economy. Remember that? Obama has not yet really gotten started with what he's going to do to you yet. Not at all. All right, I'll take the calls. I'll take the calls. We're still ahead of the curve. New York, WR. Joe, go ahead. You're on the Savage Nation. Joe, on the
Hello,
Savage.
Michael, yes, I want to talk about Al Gore. What the liberal mind does is they use smoke screens of liberalism. So they'll come out with these liberal causes, whether it's global warming or population control, for their own corruption. Now, I know for a fact that a friend of mine, a doctor who practices in Tennessee, told me years ago that the Gore estate, which he lived next to, was strip mining. They're involved in strip mining for zinc, all of Tennessee. And they would just leave the land like that. So there's total hypocrisy.
But Al Gore's father worked for Occidental Coal, one of the largest polluters of its time. Much of Al Gore's fortune was based on oil and coal. You know that.
Absolutely. And this is just the way they operate. It's the modus operandi.
Right, but here's the part that galls me. I don't mind that people are corrupt and out for themselves. I understand how the world works. But how do they get away with it is what bothers me. How do they get away with it? Who actually believes Al Gore? Who actually believes Michelle Obama out there? Who, with more than an 80 IQ, could believe a word Michelle Obama says?
Well, the liberal media, the left-wing media, if they get them on their side, they're going to protect them. And that's the Machiavelli.
Well, no, we know about propaganda. We know about Leni Riefenstahl, who was the filmmaker for Hitler's propaganda minister, is the equivalent of ABC, CBS, and NBC today. There's actually no difference between the propaganda ministry of Hitler and the propaganda ministry of the United States of America. Admittedly, the crimes against humanity are nowhere in the same league, but the mentality of a compliant media is almost identical to that of the propaganda ministry of Joseph Goebbels. Why is it that it takes a Daily Mail from London to point out the absolute embarrassment and, frankly, I think illegality of Michelle Obama's abuse of the taxpayers on her trip to Africa? Where does she have the right to take her family on a trip to Africa at government expense? I've never heard of any such thing. All right, that's all. Look, that's the end of it. Most of you then agree that Michelle has the right to spend $800,000 to $1 million going to Botswana to eat deep-fried fat cakes. Houston, Texas, Lynn, you're on the Savage Nation.
Hello, Michael. I agree 100%. I'm fed up. I'm sick of it. They go on a vacation. It's like she goes on a vacation every other week on our dime. This is ridiculous.
But she's flying a military transport plane to Africa to use in her local travels on top of flying in a Boeing 747 Air Force 2 with her mother, mind you. You know, no one's really talked about it. Why is Michelle Obama's mother living in the White House? Have you ever heard of a mother-in-law living in a White House?
I don't remember, but
I want to know why this is not a major topic for the American media. I've never heard it now, and it could be historically that a president had a mother-in-law in the White House. It's possible. I don't know. But never have we seen a mother-in-law, that is Michelle's mother, Mrs. Robinson, I believe is her name, so intricately involved in decisions of a president. Apparently, he listens to her. He actually listens to this woman with regard to government policy. Can you believe that this country has fallen to this level? All right, well, let's move on. What do you want to talk about? 1-800-449. You want to talk about Michelle Bachmann? Michelle Bachmann announced that she's running for president of the United States. A lot of people are excited by it. I haven't given you my opinion. Let's see a clip 22. We'll talk about Michelle.
I am Michelle Bachmann. I am running for the president of the United States.
Oh, wait a minute. You're not running for the president. You're running for the presidency. But if she was running for the president, it means she would try to leap in Obama's arms? Is that what she just... Then she'd be a stalker if she was running for president. I'm just kidding. I like Michelle Bachmann. But play that again, because I have a new gaffe that the liberal media will steal from me. All right, I don't really care who does. Go ahead.
I am Michelle Bachmann. I am running for the president of the United States.
We better report that to the Secret Service, because there could be a bit of stalking involved here. If she's running for the president of the United States, then we may have a problem here. I know the vermin in the media made an issue of her talking about where in Texas John Wayne was from. You know, that shows you how frightened they are of her. I frankly think she'd be a decent president. I don't care about her gaffes. Everyone makes mistakes. She is a tax attorney. I think she could win, by the way. And they're afraid of her. She's if Sarah Palin, she's not. Okay, you betcha's out of the picture. You betcha's gone. I can guarantee you that. You betcha's finished. But Michelle Bachmann, I mean, is a viable candidate for at least, I'd say, a 30-day cycle. She's good for a 30-dayer. There's no question about that. Now, I could ask you if you'll vote for Michelle Bachmann, but what's the point of engaging and indulging ourselves in this? My dog already went to sleep when I said that. He rolled over on the couch and said, oh, no, not that again, Dad. And his eyes rolled. So I will stay away from that topic. But I do want to say one other thing about Congresswoman Bachmann. Do you remember approximately a year and a half ago when she was about, when she was running for her congressional seat again, and she was almost finished in politics? She came on this show, and she basically appealed to you, the audience, for funding to help her defeat Nancy Pelosi, who was trying to throw her out of Congress. Do you remember that? Beowulf, what were her exact words? It's very important that we memorialize this, almost like in a legal case, because I've got something to report to you about Michelle Bachmann on this show. Beowulf, what did she actually say? Do you remember? Come on the air.
Don't recall Beowulf. The exact words, but we can track them down.
Michelle Bachmann came on this show. We don't know the exact words, but she said something to the effect of she's been targeted by Nancy Pelosi. She asked me and my audience to send money to her website, right, Beowulf? That's true.
Yes.
And you sent a lot of money. I don't know how much, but it was enough to help save her bacon when it was about to burn up in the fire. And as a result of the Savage Nation, thank goodness, she was reelected to her congressional seat, and now she's a viable candidate to run after the president. I mean, to run for the presidency. And so, therefore, we asked Michelle Bachmann to appear on the Savage Nation. And thus far, we've been told she's not available. Now, I'm not offended by this, nor am I shocked by this. I expect this from all politicians. I'm not only a realpolitik man, I'm also understanding of the fact that all politicians are fundamentally out for themselves. And when it comes down to remembering those who helped them when they were neediest, they remember nobody. So having said all of that, I'll be right back.
Savage.
What a difference a day made. 24 little hours. What the sun and the flowers.
And the flowers. Compare her to Michelle Obama. I mean, who would you rather listen to? Ms. Washington or Miss Robinson? How are you, Mrs. Robinson? So we have Michelle Bachmann saying she wants to run for the president. You know, if I said that, the Secret Service would come knocking at my door. Look at the difference in the use of a noun. I mean, they're both nouns. President is a noun and presidency is a noun. You know, remember from high school, a noun is a person, place, or a thing. So Michelle Bachmann says, I want to run for the president. That's a noun. What she meant to say is, I want to run for the presidency. Because although it's considered a crime to run for the president, that's considered assault, or at least a potential assault, running for the presidency is considered, well, a norm these days. It seems that everyone does it, from Giuliani to Newt Gingrich to Bozo the Clown. So look at the difference in the use of a noun. And while you're doing that, look at the difference in the use of a frown. New York City, WOR, Gene, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Michael, you might be banned in England, but they love you in Rome, Italy. In a recent trip, I just came back, and the hotel staff went up to me, and basically their perception of Obama is like Pied Piper, and they were asking me what my opinion was. So I said to them, if you really want to find out what's going on in the United States, I went behind the counter, the front desk, and I got on the Internet, and I accessed Michael Savage's website. These guys read your website, and it was unbelievable, their transformation so far as the perception of our president.
Well, I mean, just looking at the articles I post, you mean they don't even see these articles in Italy?
All they get is CNN and BBC.
Well, how about getting the show in Italy? Can they listen to it on the web? Sure they can.
Yes. And so what happened?
Yeah, but wait a minute. I don't do the show in Italian. I do it in English, right?
They could speak English. So what
you're speaking in English, huh?
Yeah, so what happened was they would read your website,
And in the morning, my wife would be sleeping. I would go downstairs, and they would discuss everything that you had on your website. And then I had your book, Trickle Up Poverty.
Oh, you carried that to Rome? They let you land?
I was reading it on the flight, and we took the trains from Rome to Florence, and we took a cruise around.
Yeah.
It was absolutely incredible. And the interesting thing about it was these American tourists, they would come into the hotel and check in, and basically they really weren't interested in the people themselves, just at the next cocktail party that they went to Rome. So they would discuss, and they looked down at the people there because we have a black president. So then they.
So you mean because it's a black president, he's cool and he's good? Everything he does is just great. All right, look, that's easy to, you know, that's an easy assumption. That's how he gets away with what he gets away with. There's no question about that. So now that you're back in New York, what are you, back to work?
I just came back. The problem is I'm an average.
But, I mean, are you retired or you work or you just travel or what?
I work, but I take 3 months off a year. I have a home in Naples, Florida, and unfortunately, I don't get you.
Oh, you're a Napoli Don?
Yeah.
Well, are you a Napoli Don? I mean, what do you do there? What do you do there for 3 months?
I just travel. My wife.
Yeah.
My
all right. Yeah. You just travel like Mr. Bulger travels to Santa Monica, huh?
So listen to what happened.
By the way, there is no truth to the rumor that Whitey Bulger and Anthony Weiner are related.
I wish they were.
Well, no. They said they captured him last week. I think you're out of the country. So his real name, I think, is Bulger, right? They couldn't pronounce it Bulger. So I said, if they pronounced it Bulger, we're liable to confuse him with a congressman from New York.
But the interesting thing about this trip was, after it was over, when I left, about 15 or 20 of the staff came out onto the street thanking me to give them a new insight insofar as our president.
And my God. Well, and what good does that do us, though, that the Italians, 10 Italians, know that he's a common con man?
Yeah, but the interesting perspective is that it tells you, gives you an insight. And
well, it just shows you, right, if more people listened to the Savage Nation and read the website, maybe they would wake up to the danger that he's put us in. Do you know that, I'm not going to go into the financial thing right now, but do you realize that our debt crisis is worse than that of Greece?
You're absolutely correct.
The actual debt that each individual owes in America is greater than that than the individuals who owe the debt in Greece per capita. Let's put it to you that way.
But the problem is there's an overall perception that's been created by the Democrats and by the media that...
Well, all right. What could you do? So you're back in New York. You like it? You hate it? How does it look when you come back from Rome?
I hate it.
You hate it? Why? Well, what do you hate about New York compared to Italy?
New York, it's a very fast pace.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot more crime. They don't appreciate life. And to be honest with you...
Well, the way people eat in Italy is very amazing, how long they take to have a meal. You know, I'm like a fast eater. I'm a speed eater. I'm an American, and I can't help it. I don't like lengthy meals. But when I go to San Francisco, to North Beach, to North Beach Restaurant, my friend owns it, Lorenzo, right? I mean, when they eat, Italians, when they eat, it's like an hour. Everything is forever. Every meal, every course is a conversation and a this and a that. I don't have the patience for it, to be honest with you.
Well, they know how to enjoy life. The simple.
I don't know how to enjoy life. I'm a worker. I'll be honest with you. To me, the automat was the greatest invention of the West. Does the automat still exist in New York? That went out a long time ago, right?
Oh, yeah. That went out probably about 40 years ago.
People don't even know what it is. You know, I think the automat could make it again, where you went in and they had circular things and you put coins in and dishes came out. I thought that was incredible.
Yeah, but the problem is they would break into those things and walk out with the food. That's the temperament that the people
have. Oh, you mean people would break the things today? Yeah. And you got people who would reach in and grab the worker's hand and pull it through and steal their wedding ring.
To be honest with you, I'm basically fed up with the United States altogether. And I found
Are you sure you're not a Democrat? You're starting to sound like an Al Gore voter.
No. And
so what do you do for a living? You are a Napoli Don, right? You just like the show?
I'm a partner in an accounting firm, so I specialize.
Oh, yeah, you and Bernie Madoff, that kind of accounting, I get.
I specialize in evading taxes.
Oh, stop it. Oh, boy, you know how to hurt a guy, don't you?
But I tell you, if you want to find the perfect spot to live, there's a place in Uruguay
And it's called Punta del
Oh, Uruguay. Yeah, I heard it. There's a few good empty villas on some of the uprivers there that the Nazis left behind after they were captured by the Israelis. Yeah, there's some nice waterfront property.
And I was recently there. And I was
Uruguay. I hear Uruguay has an interesting nightlife, by the way.
It's in Buenos Aires. That's my spot where ultimately I'm going to end up.
Why? But Buenos Aires is in Argentina, isn't it?
But they're very close. They're about an hour away.
Well, what do you prefer, Uruguay or Paraguay? Which Nazi hideout do you like better?
Uruguay.
Well, why? What's the difference? I never knew the difference. What's the difference between the Uruguayans and the Paraguayans?
The spelling.
Oh, stop. That's really good. That's like North and South Carolina, I guess, down there, huh?
But the interesting thing I was saying is we were having cocktails on the beach, and all of a sudden these gentlemen yelled, "Hey, is that New Jersey and New York?" And they were all from Chicago.
Where?
When we were in Punta del Este, which is in Uruguay.
And what were they, the former administration of Illinois?
Well, that's where Sanford took his girlfriend.
Sanford who?
The governor.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's interesting. So that's a new hangout now for the corrupt. They go to Uruguay now.
Like a king for 72,000.
I saw a show. I was scanning the dial the other night on HBO, and they have a Latin channel, Sexo Latino or something, and they showed the nightlife of Uruguay in Spanish, and they showed the women and the streets and the nightlife in Uruguay. Did you see that show?
They're like models. We were on the beach, and all of a sudden, the women. There's no heavy people in Uruguay.
No heavy people?
No heavy people.
Well, what do they eat there? Maize and squid? What do they live on?
It's predominantly fish.
Fish.
Fish and beef.
Fish and beef. Well, it's hard to gain weight. I mean, if you don't eat a lot of grain, you'll basically, you're on a low-carb diet, and you'll stay svelte.
They walk, and they're very conscious of their looks.
So are you married? Are you allowed to say this or not married?
Yeah, my wife lives in Florida, and I live in New Jersey.
Oh, so you're in separate zip. You're in different zip codes.
We have conjugal visits once every 6 weeks.
Stop it! Oh, so you are a Napoli Don.
Why would it go that far?
Oh, you see, I'm trying to probe. You live in New Jersey, and she lives in Florida. Come on, you're making this up.
No.
How many years are you married?
30.
So when did you decide you wanted to live in different states and stay married, by the way?
8 years ago.
And she has a boyfriend. You have a girlfriend?
No. Can't afford that. My partners each have gone through at least 1 to 3 wives.
Yeah. And what you're doing is you're trading one heartache for another.
No, it's you're trading one very expensive proposition for another. If you have to get out of your system, you should be very discreet.
Well, that's your problem, not mine. But so, what do you do with all your spare time?
I work quite a bit. I donate my time, and I'm addicted to Michael Savage. In fact, my wife knows when she comes up to New Jersey from 6 to 8 o'clock, the first thing she says, "Are you listening to Mike?" So if there's ever a reason for my divorce, it could be you.
Oh, I drove a wedge between you and your wife because you paid no attention to her during broadcast hours.
Well, the interesting thing about
Let me ask you something. You're a good talker, Gene, honestly. I have a question, though. This is an interesting question. Like, indulge me for a minute. What do I represent in your life? Like, what am I in your life?
You're very entertaining. An interesting thing. I started listening to you 12 years ago. Because I do a lot of night meetings. And
yeah.
I was driving my car, and I had your station on. I thought you were much younger initially before I saw you. And
I sound younger than I am. I'm young at heart. I'm very young inside. I'm like a 30-year-old inside. I got to tell you something. I could beat myself up at 30. I figured that out the other day. I was looking at myself in the mirror lifting weights, and I realized if I met myself and I was a 30-year-old me, I could beat him up.
And the interesting thing about it...
Did you hear what I just said? It's an interesting statement. As an older man, have you thought back on your younger self? Aren't you mentally stronger than you were when you were younger?
Oh, absolutely.
And if you met you at 30, even though the 30-year-old is physically, theoretically stronger, because you have a stronger mind, couldn't you defeat that 30-year-old self?
Absolutely.
You see, men don't know this. They don't understand it, but the older guy who has not lost his marbles and is in reasonable shape is not a pushover.
No. And you could see that in some instances on the beach or in the bar or whatever it is.
Well, I mean, I'm not into fighting in that regard. I'm just saying, I just thought about that. It was an interesting observation. I entertain myself by thinking, you know what I'm saying? So in addition to being entertaining, you find me intellectually boring? I'm just sort of a clown, no, like Bozo the Clown?
You're just the opposite, because the thing is, insofar as the way you approach your discussions, first of all, I don't know how you choreograph your program, because if you listen to the other talk shows, it's basically choreographed, and you're all over the lot. You jump.
I don't choreograph anything. It's absolutely created as I go along. It's true that the staff sends me sound for the day, and they pick stories, but it's really what attracts me as I'm going along. And it flows along according to me and according to the callers. Like this long conversation you and I have just had is going to shape the rest of the show, believe it or not.
Well, before
you disappear into the ether, Gene, do I represent a figure in your life other than a guy on the radio? Is there a person, a relative, somebody that was missing or someone who's gone whose role I have fulfilled? I fill.
Well, my father is very ill right now, and you're a very hardworking individual. And so far as, if you know how some people wish they could step in the shoes of other individuals?
Yes.
I would jump in your shoes in a heartbeat.
Well, I don't think you want to jump into my shoes. I think it would have killed another man a long time ago, frankly. Anyway, Gene, it's a pleasure to speak with you. I hope you continue to be a listener and buy all the wonderful products that my advertisers talk about on the show. I'll be right back.
Savage.
I put 120% to everything I do, even if it's washing my socks.
I am Michelle Bachmann. I am running for the President of the United States.
You're running for the President of the United States. Look, I'm going to say the joke again. She meant she's running for the presidency. That is my dog barking because I've been disturbed once again in the radio studio by a moron. Once again, an idiot has walked into the radio studio without announcement. This is the way the world works in the Savage Studio. I have no idea who just opened the door in the radio studio. It could be an assassin. Or it could be somebody bringing me a cup of hot coffee. I would not know. But this is the life I lead. If I were a famous radio host, this wouldn't have happened. But since I'm only the third largest radio host in America, these things happen to me every day. 1-800-449-8255. We're talking about the women of America from Michelle Bachmann and Michelle Obama. That's what's doing it. The two Michelles. Why we're talking about the two Michelles, Michelle Obama talking about her socks and Michelle Bachmann talking about her candidacy for the presidency. Let's go to Minnesota. Rich, welcome to the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Oh, hi, Dr. Savage. Michelle Bachmann is one shameless huckster. She is P.T. Barnum in a skirt. That's my original line. And
well, let's pause for a minute before we condemn her on my show. Are you a Democrat or a Repub?
I haven't voted for a Democrat probably since the mid-80s.
So why don't you like Michelle Bachmann? I mean, I don't quite understand the enmity towards her.
Well, here in the Twin Cities, which is basically just a cesspool of liberal loonies, you are either a hardcore conservative and you absolutely adore her, or if you're everybody else, you just can't stand her. She has just been a shameless promoter ever since she got into politics about a decade ago.
But let's pause. So is she any different than any other politician with national ambitions?
Oh, absolutely not. But I think she just deserves to be exposed. I mean, that's...
Well, what are you exposing about her other than the fact that she's ambitious?
She uses the props to get, you know, to in order to get her agenda, you know, going.
But how does that differ from any other politician who wishes to be a congressman, a senator, or a president? There are no scandals in Michelle Bachmann's closet, are there?
We don't know if there goes deeper than the rumors, and again, that's when she gets.
Well, let's start with the top. She's a very competent tax attorney, isn't that correct?
That she used to work for the IRS when she was a tax attorney. Her competency, I have no idea.
Work for the IRS. Well, that's good. I'd like to see a national leader who knows what the IRS is all about. So that's a plus as far as I'm concerned. Doesn't she have many adopted children or foster children?
What the scam of that was is that she and her husband promote the fact that they helped raise 23 foster kids from anywhere from 1 month to 1 year over a period of time. And we know nothing about the background of what was going on there.
Now that what do you mean, what was going on? Why do you assume the worst? What do you mean? Maybe she was just a good woman.
As I said, Dr. Savage, time will tell because she...
All right, well, look, I don't go along with this rumor-mongering. They're out to get Michelle Bachmann because she's a real threat to Barack Obama, frankly. That's why. She has a real viability factor, while You Betcha doesn't. This just came out from the Telegraph in London. Radio makes Britons happier than TV and the web. I knew it all along. I know why you're listening to me. Listening to the radio makes people happier and gives them higher energy levels than watching TV or browsing the internet, new research has found. Over 1,000 Britons were polled via their smartphones and asked to record what media they were consuming and to rate their mood and energy levels while doing so. Radio came out on top, beating both TV and online, in a study called Media and the Mood of the Nation, blah, blah, blah. So their happiness goes up when listening to a radio show versus not consuming any type of media at all. So they say that radio is a lifestyle support system that makes them feel better about their lives. Immense potential of radio to influence emotions. And you take a man like me with a great voice, a God-given gift. I have a gift of a voice and a gift of a brain, the ability to put two and two together. And that's why you listen to the Savage Nation, because I actually vibrate your brain better.
Savage.
Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
One, two, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. Five, six, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock. Nine, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, rock. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. Put your glad rags on. Join me home. We'll have some fun when the clock.
Join me now as we talk about the death of a civilization right here on the Savage Nation. The world is changing, my friends. The world is changing. Holland, or the Dutch, if you want to put it that way, has become less liberal and more sane over the last few years. The far-right government, actually there's a far-right party in Holland, says that, as you well know, Islam is not compatible. But because liberals are mentally deranged, they actually don't even understand the danger they're in. In Holland, though, they're waking up, while here in America, we're going in the wrong direction. They're cracking down on pot clubs. We're opening up more pot clubs. They're cracking down on free prostitution. We're trying to liberalize prostitution, which leads us to a question, not about the two Michelles, but about prostitution. I've always wanted to talk about that with you and ask you if you think prostitution should be legalized in the United States of America. Now, I know this is it's a pretty difficult question for many people who think that the immediate answer should be no, it should remain illegal. But it is called the oldest profession for a reason. It certainly has been around before politicians stole the mantle from the prostitutes. But the fact of the matter is, look at how many politicians' lives have been ruined by using, prostitutes, okay? So the question is, do prostitutes save marriages or destroy marriages? Do prostitutes spread disease or actually contain disease? Is prostitution something to be reviled, revered, or simply decriminalized? You see, I didn't say legalize it as much as I would say should it be decriminalized. There's a big difference between decriminalizing something and legalizing something. There's a big difference between condoning something such as prostitution and decriminalizing it. And there are arguments to be had on both sides of the issue. I think we should have that discussion only because I'm bored of talking about Michelle Obama's abuse of taxpayer funds and the election. All I'm hearing from people is the election, the election, the election, as though the presidency is up for election tomorrow. You know, it's a long time from now, and a lot is going to happen. So if you care to chime in on this topic of the decriminalization of prostitution or, you know, however way you want to look at it, you know, we could even we can broaden it into drugs. People last week were arguing that the war on drugs is lost and that all drugs should be legalized, which, of course, is a crazy idea. As you well know, marijuana is the most dangerous of all drugs. The medical evidence is quite overwhelming that the toxins found in marijuana smoke are very carcinogenic. And, of course, the foolish young children, I don't blame them. They've been brainwashed from youth. Many of them were put on prescription drugs in early childhood by the evil pediatricians that they were sent to. In cahoots with the drug companies, kickbacks and whatnot. So the children don't have a chance. They don't even understand that they're going from drug to drug and bouncing from, let us say, mood-altering drugs such as Ritalin to marijuana in order to stabilize their moods and then going on to harder drugs. I don't blame the children at all. I blame the medico-pharmaceutical establishment, which is as corrupt as you can get. So if you'd like to talk about the war on drugs and or the war on prostitutes, go ahead. 1-800-449-8255. Or if you would rather not talk about the world's oldest profession, but the second oldest profession, which is politics, we can do that as well right here on the Savage Nation. Michelle Obama's goodwill tour in Africa cost taxpayers $800,000. Al Gore wants you to stop having kids. Economically speaking, Greece is teetering on the edge of bankruptcy as protesters riot in the streets. I don't know if you know this, but the share of the national debt for each Greek citizen is $44,000 per person. And what is the share of the national debt for each person in the United States? $45,000. How long is it going to be until we see what's happening in Greece happen here? That's a very interesting question. The United States certainly is in very bad shape because of Obama, because of his rapid, insane, drunken spending. The country is broke. Now let's take calls on the prostitution issue, and you're going to see something interesting here. You're going to see the male viewpoint, and then you're going to see the female viewpoint. And I'll bet you that you're going to see a dividing line pretty much along the divided along the sexes. So let's begin with a female, Joe, in New York City on WOR. What do you think about prostitution? Should it be decriminalized or should it be continue to be illegal?
Well, I lived in Reno, Nevada, and you know it's legal there in the outskirts of the town. I didn't like it because I think that it encouraged men, because it was illegal, to think that it was okay and to cheat on their wives. And
you mean it would be it encouraged them to, because it was legal, not illegal. It was legal in Nevada.
Right.
Right. And of course the word the description of where it occurred, outskirts, is very apt in a certain way, but we'll play with those words another time. So you think it destroyed marriages or supported marriage?
Well, I think if the wives found out about it, it was extremely hurtful. And I know that some marriages were destroyed.
All right. Now, this is absolutely a truth, what you just said. However, not to play devil's advocate, but to play rational advocate here, isn't it also true that when there is no sex between parties, if a man indulges in such a thing and stays in the marriage, it's actually helpful towards marriage?
I think if the woman doesn't know about it, probably. But, a lot of this no sex in marriage has to do with both parties. And if the man is, you know, partially responsible due to his behavior, then he thinks that, you know, since there's no sex, it's okay to go outside the marriage. And he takes, he doesn't take as much responsibility for, you know, the behavior in marriage.
No, I hear you. So it's a reversal of the 60s. You're saying if it don't feel good, don't do it.
Well, if it hurts.
Thank you for the call. 1-800-449-8255. Let's take the other side of the coin. Tom in New York on WOR. Are you for or against prostitution being decriminalized?
Well, I think it should be decriminalized because it's a business, and as long as the girls are seeing a doctor, you know. One other thing, this woman, she hits her husband in bed, and he says, "What's that for?" And she says, "That's for being a lousy lover." So he hits her back, and she says, "What's that for?" And he says, "That's for knowing the difference, you know."
Oh, that's bad. That reminds me of something that occurred when I was a local talk show host, 14, 15 years ago. I don't know how it came up, but we were talking point of view, you know. So one wise guy called me from New York, and he said, it was from San Francisco. I was on in San Francisco, and he said, "Hey, Mike," he said, "I don't know what you're talking about, premature ejaculation." He said, "It takes me 30 seconds. I give him a chance."
There you go. Take care.
I told that joke last night to a couple of friends in a restaurant in San Francisco. They got a kick out of it. It's very funny. It's a male joke. You know, women don't like it. It's very degrading. But, let's not get into that. This is a family radio show. And I think that we should continue to talk about topics that are a little uncomfortable once in a while, don't you? Yes or no? You want to talk about this legalizing prostitution or not? I mean, we're adults. I mean, we're living in a country that's changing. It's changing in ways we know and in ways we can't even understand. And what we're seeing is the tip of the iceberg. And what's going on under the tip of the iceberg, underwater, is what I'm talking about. I talk about what's under the water. I'm talking about the iceberg below the water. And I think these social issues are what's going on under the water. So I think it's worth talking about decriminalizing some drugs, decriminalizing prostitution. Or if you don't agree with that, then take the other side and tell us why. Bill in Kansas, go ahead. You're on the Savage Nation.
Michael, we've talked before about Sunni and Shia in Iraq. We've also talked about the fellow that hung himself, and I set a scenario together for you regarding how he would have done it and why it might have been a hit. But my business in special operations has been to either...
Wait, I missed something. You said something. What was a hit?
There was a financial wizard who had been found hung someplace, and you asked for someone to call in and say how could it have been set up as other than a personal hanging, and I said it could have been a hit. So I'm giving you...
I swear to God, I forgot that call. It was so long ago. So you're calling now about which topic? Prostitution?
I'm talking about prostitution, but I wanted to establish some bona fides with you for a moment because we have discussed some weighty issues before, and my job in special operations has been to either stabilize or destabilize societies.
Oh,
and I want to draw on that from the perspective of if you would like to stabilize our society, which is currently destabilized, then we do not need to mess with role definitions. In other words, we're happy to go out and promote the snail darter and the spotted owl, that they could live the way they were designed to live. But we have the habit of tinkering with our own species, and you're a biologist, you know this. When you tinker with the basic roots of animals, plants, or whatever, then oftentimes the second and third order effects can't be judged in advance. If we would like to go back to a time when...
You're breaking up, Bill. You're absolutely breaking up. I know you're on some kind of special ops phone from somewhere deep in the bowels of some defense agency. I hope. I pray to God. I hope to God you still work for the government, because the way I feel, I don't know who is in the government anymore. I wish there were more guys like you. Is there any way to go to your mother's phone somewhere in town?
Yes, just a moment. Let me just turn off.
Turn off the special ops phone, and just because you're an intelligent guy, you have a lot to add, and it would be fun to actually hear what you have to say. You're against legalizing prostitution in plain English, correct?
I'm against legalizing prostitution and legalizing drugs.
because if your issue is to promote the development of the American family, which is what gave our country, as well as many other countries, I mean, Muslim families are well-defined, even though we don't agree.
Absolutely. That's why Muslims are taking over the world and will probably dominate the earth within 30 years. It's because they don't muck around with the fundamentals. There's no question that they know what a man is and a woman is, and they also believe in large families, and they really have no tolerance for the kind of idiocy that we tolerate, in plain English. Is that correct? Did I say it exactly the way it is?
No, you did, and I mean, as a professional, you are undoubtedly familiar with Maslow's hierarchy of needs. I believe that there is a sort of Maslow's hierarchy of needs for society, such that when they end up in a situation...
Okay, I'm going to have to ask you to call the show back on a regular line. I don't mean to be difficult, but my audience is number one, and they couldn't hear you, and you're making a lot of sense. Now, before we take a break, I'd like to play Michelle Bachmann announcing she's running for the president, and Michelle Obama, the two Michelles, saying that she does everything 120%. Go ahead.
I am Michelle Bachmann. I am running for the president of the United States.
I put 120% to everything I do, even if it's washing my socks.
Okay, this tomfoolery has to stop. I'll be right back to stop it.
Savage.
If ever the devil was born without a pair of horns, it was you, Jezebel, it was you.
The oldest profession, the world's oldest profession. Now, we could call up Elliot Spitzer to give us his opinion on should prostitution be decriminalized or legalized, but I want to read you a five-minute introduction to the debate on prostitution. One, is it a victimless crime? Is it a victimless crime? There's two sides to that. Some say it is a victimless crime, and some say it is not a victimless crime. How about free choice? There are a lot of people who prefer to be prostitutes. Should they have the right to have freedom to choose to be a prostitute because of, let's say they have psychological issues, or let's say it gives them a sense of controlling men, and they do it for that. Or let's say they're what in the old days would have been called a nymphomaniac, and that they could never be in any relationship other than as a prostitute with many different men. Shouldn't that be a free choice issue? What about morality? Pro would say prostitution as an institution is evil. It doesn't matter if it is the world's oldest profession, it's still wrong. What about the other side, which says, why is it illegal to charge for what can be freely dispensed? Sex work is no more moral or immoral than the chocolate or distilling industries. That's the head of a group of prostitutes called Coyote. How about human trafficking? And does this encourage human trafficking? I mean, would legalizing prostitution or decriminalizing it encourage or discourage human trafficking? It's an interesting question. How about women and violence? Would decriminalization better protect people in the sex industry from violence and abuse? Or would it increase it? Some would say it's a cruel lie to suggest that decriminalization or legalization will protect anyone in prostitution, because it is not possible to protect someone whose source of income exposes them to the likelihood of being raped on an average of once a week. In other words, even if it's legal, you're still going to get men who are going to hurt them or kill them. Okay, so that's a reality of it. There are a lot of sick men out there. You understand that? How about HIV/AIDS prevention or any other disease? That's a big one. There are many people listening to this show who have no real moral qualms about prostitution one way or the other, but they're terrified of the disease issue, as they should be. And those on the side against it, the con side, would say that even if you test a prostitute every week for HIV, she'll test negative for at least the first 4 to 6 weeks and possibly the first 12 weeks after being infected. So that means that while the test is becoming positive and the results are becoming known, the prostitute may expose up to 630 people to HIV. And this is under the best of circumstances, with testing every week and a four-week window period. It also assumes that the prostitute will quit working as soon as he or she finds out the test is HIV positive, which is, by the way, very unlikely. So in order to slow the global spread of HIV/AIDS, we should focus our efforts on abolishing prostitution. That's according to a gentleman named Jeffrey Barrows, health consultant on human trafficking for the Christian Medical Association. On the other side, on the prostitute legal side, they say the other thing. And I can't even read it because it doesn't make any sense, truthfully, the other side. How about the prevalence of rape? Those who want it legalized say that it's estimated that prostitution will legalize in the U.S. The rape rate would decrease by 25%, which I don't know how they come to that. I have no idea how they can come to that. I don't understand that one. The other side says a culture in which women can be bought for use is one in which rape flourishes. Which side do you agree with? Which side do you agree with?
Savage.
You know, it's interesting to me that none of the politicians talk about any of the social issues that plague the rest of us. Think about it. Sure, the economy is king. We understand that. If you don't have a job and you can't support yourself and your family, the rest doesn't matter. But whatever happened to leadership? Whatever happened to authority figures discussing moral issues, issues such as we are discussing today on the Savage Nation? And it's an interesting cultural observation unto itself that it has fallen upon some of us in the media to take up the mantle of discussing issues that really matter to families in America, such as should drugs be decriminalized or legalized? Should prostitution be decriminalized or legalized? This is the issue that we're talking about right now. I stumbled upon it. I didn't plan on talking about it, but we're very deeply discussing it on the Savage Nation. I want to challenge you right now because you're going to be shocked by this. I just found something that I thought was immensely interesting. We're going to read to you the percentage of men by country who paid for sex at least once. In other words, male clients or johns of prostitutes worldwide from 21 studies conducted between 1994 and 2010. Okay? And they included only 15 countries for which they found data of men paying for sex at least once in their lifetimes. Which country, before I read this list, would you think is the highest in the use of prostitutes and the lowest? Well, what's the point of answering? Don't call me. But you're going to be shocked by the answer. Again, it's not a very scientific study, but it's certainly a starting point. The number one country for the use, or let us put it this way, for men who paid for sex at least once, the John's chart, Cambodia, 80% of men have gone to prostitutes at least once. Thailand, 75% of men have gone to prostitutes at least once in their lifetime. Italy, 45% of men have gone to prostitutes at least once. Spain, 39% of men. Japan, 37% of men. The Netherlands, 21% of men. The United States, 20% of men. China, 20% of men. Switzerland, 19%. France, 16%. Australia, 15%. Sweden, 13%. Finland, 13%. Norway, 12% of men. And strangely enough, the United Kingdom, only 8.8% of men admit to having gone to prostitutes at least once in their life. I guess that's because they're not interested in women to begin with, so it's at the very, very bottom of the chart. And I suppose the reason in Norway that the number of men who go to prostitutes is so low is because they're so high on drugs, they don't even want to go to women at all. And then if you look at the chart the other way, Cambodia and Thailand being at the top of the chart, it seems to be endemic or a part of their society to use women in this manner. Cambodian men are quite ready to admit that they seek the favors of prostitutes, even though they may be married and have two or three girlfriends on the side. It's part of their life. That's according to Leela Barak in Business Times magazine. Thailand. Do I have to talk about Thailand? I mean, but I'm curious about the bottom of the list, which is the United Kingdom. The number of men paying women for sex being the lowest of this group. It's very interesting. Now, the rate of divorce has increased in England, as has the proportion of men who were never or previously married. And this may explain some of the increased demand for commercial sex. But nevertheless, I think the women and their lack of morality in England, by and large, is also somewhat accounting for the low rate of men who go to prostitutes. They don't have to, since so many of the women are acting like prostitutes, in plain English. I mean, you know, one of the things I specialize in is not mincing words. And when you have a society like the United Kingdom where the women basically are all, the younger ones act like prostitutes, which is no different than many, many regions of America. We don't have to spell it out and become graphic and make burlesque-like jokes here. But you know that the Hollywood establishment is pushing the image of women being like men. You know, if it feels good, do it. Why not do it in the road? And many of us are disgusted by this behavior. It also accounts for the fact that the Caucasians amongst us have the lowest birth rate in the United States of America amongst all races. And that is because the women don't want to have babies. They just want to have fun. So let's get back to the main issue, and let's take your calls right here on the Savage Nation. Alice, in New York on WOR, where do you stand? Are you for or against legalizing prostitution?
Oh, where, well, you jump? It's kind of a gray area. I'm for it to be legalized and regulated. Why? Well, it's like you said before with the disease. I mean, if you look back through history, during the Civil War, a lot of these guys were going out away from home for the first time seeing prostitutes, and the generals were having a big problem because they were losing a quarter of their guys to all the various venereal diseases of the day, you know, before they even got out on the battlefield. And their solution for it was to legalize it and regulate it. And that's what they did. And they saw an immediate drop in disease. You know, they had the prostitutes. They would have to go get a license for prostitution, go to a doctor and get checked.
Well, but here, look, there's certainly an argument to be made for that. But as I mentioned to you earlier, just because they go to a doctor doesn't mean that the next man to be with them is going to be disease free and not pass. And she's not going to pass it on to the third man, the second man after him.
Oh, well, no, absolutely not. But I'm saying it reduces the chances, you know. I mean, and like you said before, of course, if they're diagnosed, are they going to stop working? Probably not. That's their bread and butter.
No, I hear you, and I'm not trying to be, kind of naive about any of this either. Are you yourself at all familiar with this practice?
Not really.
I'm trying to find out if you're in the biz.
Yeah, it's, people are going to do it anyways. You know, it is the world's oldest profession, and if people are going to do it anyways...
Well, sure, and if they get caught, they wind up on CNN. What could be better?
Well, yeah, well, it could be good or it could be bad, you know?
All right. We don't have to make any juvenile jokes about it, but it's an interesting discussion, and we haven't yet heard from the other side to the extent that I'd like to hear from the other side, whereas it's saying it should not be legalized from the moral point of view, from the family point of view. So let's go to Patricia in Arizona, who takes that side. Go ahead, Patricia.
Yeah, I just, is this going to be one of our daughter's career choices?
If you turn on HBO, it makes it look like it's a choice between becoming a lawyer or a prostitute and working in a cat house.
There's a lot. I work at a school. There's a lot of messed up kids in this world. And is this going to be something that is going to allow our sons to keep abusing our daughters and our daughters just taking that? I don't understand how people can want to do that. You know, that, oh, yeah, one of my first jobs was, I didn't work in a fast food restaurant. I worked in a brothel. You know, it's ridiculous. It's really ridiculous. And
well, here's the problem. I don't even think we'd be having this discussion if America wasn't melting down into a third world nation right in front of our eyes. In other words, if we didn't have the debasement of our society, promulgated by so many different forces, and I don't have to name them for us to know who we're talking about, I don't think we'd even be talking about it. 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, we wouldn't be having this discussion. But because we have been debased to the point that we are debased, take a look at the White House. Take a look at how the two occupants of the White House have trashed the White House, debased the presidency itself, abused the presidency. That is why we're even talking about legalizing prostitution, pros and cons. It's because we are very much like a third world nation on a moral level right now. There's no question about that. Texas, Matt, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Hey, hi, Dr. Savage. Yes, I'm against it. And you can talk about disease. You can talk about everything. But what it really boils down to is a person seeks someone outside of their marriage because they're not capable of being intimate. And they get a false sense of intimacy when they seek out a prostitute or someone outside their marriage. Now, it's not always the guy's fault. It takes two. And,
but wait, you're saying outside the marriage. What if the man is single and cannot meet a woman? Or what if the man is single and doesn't have the time to go dating? Or what if the man is single and is afraid to date someone for fear that she's crazy or out stalking him and he just wants to use someone to relieve him? I mean, I'm laying it online here as though this is a clinical discussion. I'm not taking that side. How do you answer that point of view?
That's fair. For a guy that's single, I'm not saying legalize it. If that's what he chooses to do, that's his choice. Go ahead and do it. But you're still going to lack the ability to be intimate, and it takes work. I mean, if you look at intimacy between a man and a woman, that's probably the highest form of intimacy that man has been created with and can enjoy on this earth, and it takes work. Okay.
Now, let's talk about this from a perspective that a child could understand, because many children listen to the show. How do you define intimacy?
Being able to share anything about yourself that you're afraid that other people might think you're the normal or unusual. And when you're
And bringing that into the sexual arena with a in a marital setting, for example.
Okay. Son, your dad and mom love one another a lot, and one of the highest forms of love that we express to each other is when we close our door at night and we make love to one another. And it's a very special time. It's the most special time that I have with my wife, whom I pledged my love to years ago at the altar of marriage. And I want you to ask me anything at any time as to how that works so that you can treat your wife the same. Michael, I went outside my marriage, and I lived in sexual sin for a long time. And I went for 7 months to a place to help me learn to be intimate, and I know it's work.
Well, you know, God bless the people from Texas. I mean, you're a straight up guy, and you laid out a scenario right now that's not commonly discussed. I've never heard it put that way, Matt. You've been through something there to have come out so clear on this.
It's intimacy. It really is. And I mean, I can ask all your listeners to think about the person or persons with whom they feel closest to, and they are the ones that have let their guard down and shared a secret of whatever kind it is, and that's a form of intimacy. And the highest form is when you take off your clothes and you love on your loved one, and she loves on you, and at the end you're both smiling and you're happy, and there's no judgment, and there's pure contentment between the both of you, and that is worth the work.
All right, man, you really made a heck of a speech right there. I think you've changed a lot of lives. I appreciate you calling the show. I never thought we'd get this seriously into this, but hey, God bless that gentleman from Texas who really knows what he's talking about. It's something that you don't joke about. I think that, you know, we grew up in a society, all of us, and we still have it, where sex is considered a ha-ha and a joke. Is it a joke? Should sex be a joke? What is sex? Is sex just a release? Is sex the most divine experience between people? Or are we overly concerned with sex and we should just, like, walk away from it already? Is it too much? You know what I'm saying? It's an interesting conversation. Elizabeth in Florida, your position is up next on the Savage Nation. Go ahead.
I love what Matt said, but most hookers or and so that's more the reality than what Matt's talking about. It's a nice idea. It is.
No way. But Matt was talking about being intimate with a wife, not with a prostitute.
Right. But I'm saying in reality, it's more of the latter, more of the kind of unintimate. But as far as the intimacy.
Wait. You mean in marriage, it's more like the masturbation, or in all interactions?
No. Most prostitutes refer
to... Yeah, we don't have to repeat it. I get it. Most prostitutes are used basically in that manner as just... they're abused, in other words. There's no intimacy.
They're like a human toilet. But anyways...
Ugh.
It'll never be made legal in this country, because even if you throw out all the morals, 70% of all strippers were the victims of molestation as children. And like, it goes up to 98% for actual streetwalkers. You've got the disease. You've got drug trafficking that goes...
Is that why they go into it? Because they were molested or abused and they were traumatized and they're still trying to appeal to daddy? I mean, is that it?
Isn't the psychology that what we learn as children is just stays with us, that even the sick stuff? You know, the child sex trafficking is huge. It's growing in Dallas, Fort Worth, Atlanta.
Wait, I missed that. The child sex trafficking?
Well, child sex trafficking, you know, the base of the sex industry, I think, is always...
In where? In Dallas, Fort Worth, what? In they're bringing in young Mexican kids?
No, I just... the child sex trafficking, that's like one of the hubs, Dallas, Fort Worth area.
But where are the girls from? Where are they coming in? Where are they bringing them in? What country?
Well, I don't know about that. I know that some stats are like 100,000 girls are even kidnapped a year and forced into child sex trafficking. They had a 2010 at, I think, Diamond's Cabaret in Texas. They had a 12-year-old girl working as a stripper. It's pretty sick. But you cannot ever, even if you throw out morals, just the base of prostitution, everything.
Well, it's also related to no men in the families. 50% of the marriages are single parents. They're women trying to raise children and work. The children are left alone a lot, and they're very vulnerable to this kind of thing. If there was a man around watching the house, I don't think you'd have as much child sex trafficking, you'd have a lot more dead people trying to touch children.
And basically, you know, parents have given up educating their children. I mean, I could very quickly educate any young girl so she would never be a stripper if she knew what those girls really endured in those clubs. Or really, if guys go into a strip club and that's a place where no one can hear you scream when there's so many things guys that are drunk and unruly and sexually charged they do to those women. And you just don't hear about it because it's kind of like the sisterhood of we're so cool and we're so hot when they know they're not. And they, you know, they don't marry. They don't have husbands who are.
Elizabeth, this again. I'm not trying to pry into your life, but how are you so knowledgeable about this world?
Oh, I'm really good at it. I mean, I've studied a lot of it. I'm not one, but I worked around certain areas like that, and also worked as a young girl around the racetrack with tons of owners and people with a lot of money. And you wouldn't believe how many times I was propositioned, even from an incredibly young age. So kind of knew that, and I've worked around, worked for madams taking care of horses and things. If you believe it or not.
But, you said horses, didn't you?
Yeah, and the funniest thing in the world is if you want to see a guy turned on, it's just you're 16 years old, you're taking care of his expensive horse, and he's standing there watching you do it. I know it's kind of a sick kind of thing. That's a race.
Well, now we're getting into another realm altogether. But so you have memories of the other world around your world of you were taking care of horses and they were taking care of something else that sounded like horses.
No, I'm just saying, you know, where there's wealth and money and girls around, you're going to have that. But the process.
Well, wait, hold on. We just said that the highest rate of prostitution in the world, or at least the number of men who frequent prostitutes, is in Cambodia, which is a poor country. So I would think that you could say that the exploitation of women is not limited to the rich.
Right, you could say that, but also in Thailand, I believe they recently made oral sex not even considered sex. I mean,
did Bill Clinton was Bill Clinton the consultant on that, or
Bill Clinton?
He must have been a special counsel to the commission on that. I'll be right back.
Savage.
It is the Savage Nation. I'm so glad that I could be the referee for the United States of America on such heady issues such as we are discussing tonight on this program, because we certainly don't hear it coming from the politicians. All they do is talk about the same garbage. Most of us are turned off from the political process. There's no leadership. I mean, you know, if you want to be a leader, then lead. Lead, lead, lead. Talk about issues that matter to the people other than issues such as the economy, which are number one in some ways, but is it number one? I mean, what does it profiteth a man if he gaineth the world and loseth his soul? Do you remember that statement? What a good, of all the riches in the world, if you end up like George Soros, a man without a soul, in my opinion. A soulless ghoul, that no matter how much money that man has, it's not enough for him because he wants more power over the people. That's an example of what Jesus was talking about. What does it profiteth a man if he gaineth the world and loseth his soul? So, yeah, the economy is real important. We know that. But is it the only thing? Is it all there is the dollar? Well, then if that's all there is, then get ready for Cambodia, USA. With 13-year-old and 8-year-old and 7-year-old girls as prostitutes, and you're going to look the other way and say, well, it's only a business. Is that what you're going to say? It's only a business? Well, it gives the poor child some income. That's what you're going to argue? Chicago, Ann, welcome to the Savage Nation on the prostitution issue. Go ahead, please.
Hi, how are you? I was a prostitute at one time.
Right, and so where do you stand, legal or not legal?
Don't legalize it now, no. It's
why?
Not good. It's, the girls nowadays are not like it used to be. They're very dirty. They'll hurt you. And some of them are so, like you were talking, they're so young. You know, it breaks my heart now knowing what I know. And I feel sorry for them.
So you worked in the golden age of prostitution.
Right. Well, in the late 70s, mid 80s.
Well, I can't comment because I don't know what the difference between then and now is. I don't quite understand the difference. It was always a harsh world, so far as I know. But I'm glad we had this discussion, Ann, and I think we should continue it right here in the Savage Nation. Which side are you on? Should prostitution be legalized, decriminalized, or should it remain illegal and become illegal even in Nevada? All this and more in the Savage Nation.
Savage. Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
So what's in the news? Well, let's see what's in the news. Malaysia Airlines says no more infants in first class on jumbo jets. Well, that's interesting. They say banning babies in the first class sections of its Boeing 747-400 super jumbo jets. A lot of people are saying, wow, good. And they're responding to complaints from first class passengers about crying infants. You see, infants are allowed to fly for free. And first class passengers complain that they can't sleep due to crying infants, even though they spent money on first class. Well, that's very interesting. No doubt, I say, you're going to have the liberals complaining that it's against children. And then what are they going to ban next? Slippery slope, huh? Let's ban smelly feet. Let's ban passengers with body odor. How about the woman who uses too much perfume? How about a man who uses too much cologne? How about the guy with sweaty armpits with a tank top on? How about someone with the pyorrhea? There it goes. 1-800-449-8255. Al Gore, Nexus, he has a new crusade, which is to limit population. America's loopiest ex-vice president is at it again. Not content with pocketing a fortune by scaring his fellow citizens with the imaginary boogeyman of man-made climate change, the prophet of doom now wants everybody to save the planet by halting population growth. You heard that right. To save Mother Gaia, it's imperative that we kill ourselves as a species. Let 1,000 flowers bloom, but be sure to have only one or two kids, lest you make climate change worse. That's very interesting, said Al Gore. Now, of course, we should be playing something for the Great White Father when he talks about this, which would be the masseuse who said she had to run from him because he was like a crazed beast. I wonder if it didn't apply to him.
He wrapped me in an inescapable embrace as I turned around, giving this come-hither look deep into my eyes and caressed my back and buttocks and breasts. I squirmed to try and get out of his grasp, telling him to stop, down several times, and I finally told him and said, you're being a crazed sex poodle.
Well, if you think that's frightening, how about identity theft? What if someone stole your credit cards and tried to destroy your life? Don't be a victim. Call my advertiser, LifeLock, today. Call LifeLock right now at 1-800-642-2289 and get 60 risk-free days just for Savage listeners. You heard me. 1-800-642-2289. Call them now. Also in the world of lunacy, San Francisco considers banning the sale of all pets. Dogs, cats, birds, hamsters, any animal that walks, flies, swims, crawls, or slithers. Unless you plan to eat it and psychologically damage San Francisco. The Humane Pet Acquisition Proposal hopes to protect everything from Great Danes to goldfish. Goldfish, guppies, gobbies, gouramis, glow-like tetras, German blue rams, no fish, no fowl, no reptiles, no amphibians, no cats, no dogs, no gerbils, no rats. If it flies, crawls, runs, swims, or slithers, you would not be able to buy it in the city named for the patron saint of animals. Representatives of the $50 billion a year pet industry call the San Francisco proposal by far the most radical ban we've seen nationwide. Animal activists say it will save small but important lives and end needless suffering. Why fish? Why not fish, says Philip Gerbel, Jerry, a member of the city's Commission of Animal Control and Welfare, and a school calls the proposal. And he says, from Descartes on up in the Western mindset, fish and other non-human animals don't have feelings. They don't have emotions. Our culture sanctions this, treating them as commodities and expendable. So you see, in San Francisco, it's legal to do the most inhumane things to each other in the name of diversity, but you can't own a pet. That's the story in San Francisco. 1-800-449-8255. What else is in the news? Well, Michelle Obama's so-called goodwill tour to Africa with her children, her mother, her friends, and her nieces will cost you, the taxpayer, as much as $800,000. That includes costs are local transportation, ribs, French fries for family and staff, and using Air Force Two. Al Gore wants you to stop having kids, and Greece is teetering on the edge of bankruptcy as protesters riot in the streets saying, dare you cut a dime from our fat government handout. We're going to burn, baby, burn. Opposition leader embraces multiculturalism in, I guess, Australia as the Dutch walk away. So, in other words, the Federal Liberal Party Council said that he was embracing multiculturalism. Meanwhile, last week, the Dutch government joined German Chancellor Angela Merkel, British PM David Cameron, and French President Nicolas Sarkozy in rejecting multiculturalism. In fact, there's new policy in Holland introduced by the center-right Dutch government, declares the Netherlands steps away from the model of a multicultural society. This legislation halts special subsidies to ethnic groups. Oh, my God. And will allow for the revocation of visas for immigrants who refuse to learn Dutch. It even slashes welfare benefits for those whose actual chances of obtaining employment are hindered by their behavior or clothing. Isn't that wonderful? Isn't that terrific? The legislation reflects concern in Europe at the social tensions arising from the presence in the midst of large unassimilated immigrant communities, mainly Muslims. The immigration bill will pass the Dutch parliament with the support of Geert Wilders, the third largest bloc in the Dutch parliament. That's very interesting. Now, he's the MP who was dragged before a court in Amsterdam and charged with counts of inciting racial and religious hatred over statements he made that were critical of Islam, the sacred religion. Very much similar to Michael Savage being banned in Britain. 1-800-449-8255. It seems that multiculturalism is definitely on the way out in Europe. They're dragging people before courts because some people deem their words to be insulting. But apparently, things are changing for the better in Europe, hopefully just in time. Now let's see what's on the little website that could, home of the Savage Nation, michaelsavage.com. Top left, Michelle's Goodwill Tour of Africa costs U.S. taxpayers up to $800,000. Well, French fries and fried fat bananas are expensive. Egypt revolution slipping from our grasp. No kidding. Egypt school book, Jews and Christians are infidels. Isn't that great what Anderson Cooper and CNN wrought? Are you interested in the United Kingdom's ban on Michael Savage? Well, there's a whole link of all the articles about this grave injustice on Michael Savage on the left. Muslim woman sues Abercrombie and Fitch over hijab. You hear they have to hire her, wearing all of her multicultural garb in a store that caters to young men. Senate Democrats push ahead with the DREAM Act. Idiots. IDF fears flotilla activists will try to kill soldiers. George Soros is trying to stack the courts, several million dollars in the past decade buying judges. Iran has developed new missiles that can hit U.S. bases in Israel. Why we're sitting and waiting, I'll never understand. Never understand as long as I can sit and talk. I'll never understand it. Girls forced to have sex change operations in India, catering to the fetish for a son. Also on MichaelSavage.com, pediatrician molests 86 kids videotaping the sex acts. I mean, it's too disgusting to even talk about. I'll take the deep-fried fat cakes and fries, please, says the first lady at a restaurant in Botswana. While nobody was watching, she thought. Murder suspects marry in rare jailhouse wedding. You got to take a look at these two dolls. Guilty of selling Obama's seat, Blagojevich. Rand Paul to TSA, I think you're clueless. No kidding. China is trying to buy Canada's oil and the United States' energy nest egg. Can you believe this? They want to buy the petroleum reserve from Obama. Why don't we just sell them our U.S. Navy? Kiss America goodbye. Bus-sized asteroid rarely missed Earth yesterday. Wow, what a close call. Woman's leg broken, others hurt in Philly mob attack. D.C. Museum showcases China human rights abuses. North Korean children begging and the army is starving. You wouldn't know that. Jewish bodies found in medieval well in England. You know, the English and their Jewish problem. Little do we know that it hasn't ended. New York, WOR. Bill, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hi, Michael. Matt from, say, I just wanted to share. I bought a 1973 Porsche about 18 years ago. I thought I was all that, and
yes,
love driving it. But now the only people that high-five me or stick their thumb up are eighth graders and old guys. So it takes.
What year is your Bill? What year is your Porsche?
It's a 73 914. It's essentially.
You know, I was never a Porsche guy. I noticed that there was a cutoff. Even when I was young and into sports cars, I was into big engine, front engine cars. I never liked the rear engine cars.
Well, you know, it's just
To me, a Porsche sounded like a machine shop with four wheels. Thanks for the call. No, I never liked the Porsche. I mean, look, the Ferrari's a rear engine car, really mid engine. I still like being pulled through a curve rather than pushing myself through a curve. But I drive at 60 in the middle lane anyway. What's the point? Who are you racing? It's actually frightening to hit the pedal on a car that's really fast. If I come around a certain a cloverleaf getting onto a certain highway, I always have to talk myself down from hitting the pedal, and I never win. The inner demon always wins. And I'm usually in second gear, and I do it. I say, don't do it. And the next thing I know, it's like, you know, bingo. I mean, there I am in the far left lane with my heart pounding. And I say, why'd you do that, Michael? You know you're not supposed to do that. This is all fantasy. You understand that. Sacramento, Michael, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Dr. Savage?
Yes.
I'm going to be going to college this fall, and I'm going to be commuting. But unfortunately,
right,
I don't have a car yet. And I was wondering, what kind of car would you recommend for a first-time car?
What's your budget?
Very slim, unfortunately.
Well, I will tell you, the few people I've known who were in your position all drove used Japanese cars, like an old Honda or something, or a used Nissan. They all drive the older Japanese cars, and they swear they run forever.
Like around maybe the 90s?
I mean, as much as I'd like to tell you to buy a used Oldsmobile, I can't do it. Or a used Chrysler. I mean, I'm sorry, I can't tell you to do that. I would think a used Japanese car with low mileage is probably a good bet.
All right?
And I know people, why didn't you tell them to buy an American car? What should I tell them to buy, a used Humvee? Maybe Arnold Schwarzenegger's Humvee is for sale. He needed that Humvee to drive all of the kids around. I mean, you got to think about it. He needed a large. He should have gotten a school bus. Schwarzenegger should have gotten a school bus with what he had going on. But Schwarzenegger, you got to admit, is a lucky man, because soon after the scandal came out of him with the maid, Anthony Weiner popped up to save his hide. It's unbelievable how some men are born under a lucky star. And I'll tell you the truth, by comparison, how do you compare a man who has a, let's say, an illicit love affair and has a baby and doesn't abort it and raises it and pays for it with a man who takes pictures of his own schmendrick and sends it around the internet? I mean, they're not in the same category of human being. I guess one went to State University of Vienna and the other went to State University of New York at Plattsburgh. I guess that's how you figure it out. Maybe the universities are better in Austria. He actually went to the University of Bodybuilding, but he did very well for a good-looking guy because he has that classic Teutonic look. Look how far he's gone on looks alone. So you ask yourself, who becomes a politician? He didn't need an education to be a billionaire actor and a governor. His education didn't matter. All that mattered is that he looked like the Teutonic god of the fantasy of most Americans. And, you know, you throw in a little chemical, and on top of that, you a few other elements, and there you are. Then you have the governor. I, Michael Savage, will be right back.
Savage.
Okay, New York City, WOR, country. Boris, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Michael. Quick point. I'm Russian, but I'm also American, and I love this country with all my heart. I mean, this is my home. It gave me and my family not just the financial freedom. I've been living here for 15 years, but also the sense of home, and that's the most important. Now, over the last 15 years, I have been always, always critical, very critical and skeptical about everything what's going on in Russia. But this is one of the cases. What I'm going to say, leave the Russia alone. It's doing exactly what every sovereign nation would have to do. okay? And I don't understand what it means, disproportional force. I think if Israel would use disproportional force, we wouldn't have the problem with Hezbollah right now. Or if America would use disproportional
force. Yeah, I agree with you. As a matter of fact, I can guarantee you that the Russian troops don't have to consult a guidebook which tells them that if they do their job, they'll go to jail and get a court-martial. In fact, if our forces act the way the Russian forces are able to act, we would have been out of Iraq 3 years ago. But that's why they tell them to go slow, to make sure we're not out of Iraq. You know that.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know what? It's probably, it's not a good thing to say, but I hope you understand. I wish that our president would have 15% or 10% what Russian president has, Vladimir Putin. Just his power. Just to say, you know what? It's my country. I got to do what I got to do. And that's the end of story.
Well, he already has whatever power he needs. He gave $48 billion in aid to Africa for AIDS without a popular vote. Where'd the money come from? By the stroke of a pen, he said, now we're going to add a little rider onto that bill and let people with HIV into the country. Again, he did it without a popular vote. He has 100% of the power right now. There's no Congress to oppose this man. He seems to be out of control. He's like King Ludwig II of Bavaria.
Unbelievable. It's unbelievable. You know what? To understand the whole depth of the problem, I think people who came here, who immigrated recently, have much, much more appreciation what this country can offer. This unbelievable country.
Absolutely. I know emigres, not only from the ex-Soviet Union, but from the whole Eastern Bloc, let's put it to you that way, which is part of the Soviet Union, of course, they all come when I run into them in the street and tell me they're terrified that this country is becoming more and more like the Soviet Union that they fled 20 years ago.
It's horrible. It's absolutely. Michael, I just want to let you make one last point, okay? I pray every single day for you, okay? You are the absolute man. You are the only man, the only voice I can hear and listen, okay? And my children as well, okay? So thank you so much. And listen, by the way, we will love you. There is a big Russian community. We all love you. You have our full support, okay? Thank you.
Well, I will come and have vodka with you one day. I can guarantee it. Thank you very much. I know I do have a big, big listenership in various parts of the country, and some of the big listenerships are in big cities. Of course, it's also dispersed throughout the country, but let's put aside me and my particular thing and my little place in the world here. Dr. Frank Germano is an author who's written about his, it's a true story, and it involves a desperate escape from an Islamic sect which falsely accused him of being a Zionist spy in 1978, and he was tried for sabotage, which is a capital crime by extremist Islamists in Morocco. Frank, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Oh, thank you, Michael.
Well, why were you accused of being a spy?
I was traveling through Morocco just on the way to the Middle East, and I walked into a mosque, and I, met the imam, and I wanted to learn about Islam anyway before I got to the Middle East, because I wanted to engage in interfaith work, which I'm doing now, which is the subject of the new book called Love and Terror in the Middle East. In any case, I walked into a mosque, and they thought it was cool at first that a Westerner wanted to learn about Islam. They wanted to convert me. It turned out I walked into the wrong mosque, and it was an extremist group out of Saudi Arabia, and they had an agenda. And so after a week of staying with them, the door was closed. They wouldn't let me out of the mosque, and their goal was clear, and they made it clear to me that they wanted to convert me so I could help recruit for them. And what got them to think that I was a spy is I wouldn't convert. And they literally changed gears after 2 weeks. Part of it, I think, was to pressure me to convert. The other part was I made enemies inside the mosque because I kept asking questions. And that you don't do. And this is a Wahhabist group out of Saudi Arabia. And when you're studying with a group like that, you accept everything. Because I was asking questions, they put me on trial inside the mosque, accused me of being a Zionist spy, and there to interfere with their black back to Islam movement. And that during that trial is when the accusation became official, and it became very scary as to what would happen if they convicted me of those serious charges.
Well, what did you do to infuriate the imams? How did you challenge their psychic beliefs?
A lot of questions. Sort of borderline philosophical, Michael. where I'd question them why they thought Muhammad was the last prophet, but the a more precise critique of Islam that I made, that they that really was a straw that broke the camel's back and made them go ballistic against me, and that's after, and then they levied charges against me as being a spy, was when I questioned the relationship to women in their communities. One quick event was one of the members of that that cult took me to his home under guard, and we had dinner. And I didn't see his wife, and I questioned him. I said, well, where's your wife? He says, well, there's no reason to meet my wife. Women have three roles in this community. They are to put the veil on, go out and buy groceries, come back, make dinner, three, have babies. And then I was livid over that, because I come from, you know, the U.S. and France, where women are, can do, you know, as much, sometimes better, things that men can do in all the professions. I critiqued them about that role of the woman in their communities. And that's when they levied charges against me. So that was not just philosophical, Michael. It was also, specific treatment of women in their communities, and other questions as well to that effect.
What did you learn in your travels between the West Bank and Israel?
Well, this this was leading up. This whole event in Morocco was leading up to get to the West Bank and Israel to engage even then, and that was 30 years ago, to engage in interfaith work. I never got there. The best I could do was to escape from this place. And 30 years later, being in Paris, it was much easier. This time I took a plane instead of going through the gauntlet of Morocco to the Middle East. And there I found a magical place. At first, the Jews that brought me in, the Kabbalist Jews that brought me in to introduce me to people, I just suggested to them I was interested in interfaith. They were skeptical. They thought, well, you know, these groups where we're talking with the Bedouins, Muslims, Christians, and Jews are going to wonder why you're there. What's your interest? Are you just there as a tourist? And so they did, the Kabbalist Jews that organized originally my first visit. This happened again 30 years after Storm Over Morocco. I was on my own, they said. It'll be up to me to show how sincere I was, and up to me to be able to integrate in these groups, depending upon if they accept me. And so this became the story, underlying story of the new book, Love and Terror in the Middle East, because I ran into so many different challenges getting through. And I also interviewed some terrorists that were on the run. The head of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, Michael, I know you probably heard of this group. I interviewed in the Jenin refugee camps because I feel that I need to work with all people, including the hardliners, for peace. And he was open. He was open to this interfaith march dialogue that I was organizing in Israel and the West Bank.
Well, are you actually encouraged about the possibility for any peace between Israel and the Palestinians?
Well, let me give you an example of what goes on. When we start the dialogue, especially with Orthodox Jews, Muslims, and Christians, they're able to sit next to each other and be sort of cordial with each other. But when we start talking, you know, they don't accept each other, in particular their religion. And they're convinced, and even though they're eating together, I try to get them to eat and drink together, talk about, you know, everyday things to break the ice. They don't accept each other's religion to the extent that they believe that the other person worships the devil. And I don't judge them. I just facilitate the dialogue. So I said, well, let's just look at all the texts. Let's look at the Old Testament, the New Testament, the Koran, and just take a look. And after a couple, 3 hours, each, for the first time, they're discovering, the Jews are discovering that a lot of things in the Koran are similar to what's said in the Torah as well as in the New Testament. And the Christians are discovering that about the Jews, that a lot of things in the Old Testament, of course, lead up to the New Testament. There's a lot of similar principles. At the end of the day, I ask the question, do you think you might share the same God? And at this point, I'm getting kind of at least a hesitation. Instead of saying, no, the other person, the Jew says the Muslim is a devil worshiper. I'm talking about the Orthodox Jew. They're saying, well, it seems that we have so much in common, it's possible. Then I leave them with the final question. Do you think then it makes sense to kill in the name of God then, if you share the same God? And I tell people, you don't have to respond to that now. Think about it. I'll be back in 3 months. This is how it goes on, Michael. But you know, let me add, though, there have been... let me add another story, because I think this answers the question as well. It's a great challenge. In fact, just 2 months ago, when I was right in the middle of writing a chapter about the Jenin refugee camp, which established the greatest defense against the Israeli troops. There was a lot of bloodshed there in the Jenin refugee camp in the West Bank, and that's what I was engaged in dialogue, and I met this man. His name was Giuliano Mayor Camus. And right in the middle of the chapter I was writing about our interfaith work that he was helping with. Now, he's a Jew. He has an Arab father, but his mother's Jewish. He lives in Palestine. He was murdered in the middle of the chapter I was drafting about what we'd done together, if that's not symbolic. So it's been with great loss, however, and great sacrifice to keeping these dialogues going. Michael, it's been a real challenge in that regard. I dedicated part of the book to him. It's not over yet, Michael. There was another Jewish-American friend who stays at the same rooming house I do in East Jerusalem, was murdered even before that. In this one, it was in Israel. So even though it's been gratifying to be able to facilitate these groups, I've lost some great friends in the process, but I do see, in spite of that, and to get really to your question, I see great progress being made in spite of these setbacks, in spite of the danger. I see people getting together is a fundamental, on the grassroots level, is a fundamental key to peace in the Middle East.
Well, what possibility is there for peace when the three religions in the Middle East don't understand that they all share the same Abrahamic God?
Michael, that's a great question, and many people have asked that question. It's a very appropriate question. It goes right to the heart of these dialogues, and often people say, well, you know, you're hitting your head against the wall. These people have been inculcated. They've been indoctrinated, some of them in extremist cults and sects and groups. How do you work with these people? Well, my approach has been more of a reprogramming approach. Let's get together. Let's get away from these church structures, even though some of the dialogues take place in synagogues and mosques and churches. Let's try to get away from the doctrine and move towards just recognizing each other as human beings who have the same needs, who have a lot in common under the Abrahamic community. Abraham being the father, one of the greatest fathers for Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, you'd think where he was buried, and Sarah was buried, and Isaac and Jacob were buried, which is in Hebron, the West Bank, that would be one of the most peaceful, loving places in the world. On the contrary, where even Abraham and Sarah were buried underneath a mosque, which is right just opposed to a synagogue, that's one of the most contested areas. So it's baffling to me. That even though we're one of the greatest fathers of Christianity, Islam, and Judaism is Abraham, that there's there's so many common denominators among the religions because of that there's still there's still so much strife in the area.
Dr. Frank Romano, thanks for being on the Savage Nation with your true story.
It's been my pleasure, and I just want to say that this new book, Love and Terror in the Middle East, that people have been asking about, in particular during events for Storm Over Morocco, is out now. And it is about what's going on today, and I do talk about Gaza as well. And the fundamentals of this book, the basis of this book, are on my website, www.frankromano, frankromano-ltcom. So frankromano-ltcom is my website. And you can find out the information, a lot about the epilogue is on there, the introduction and so forth about the book. And thank you again, Michael, so much for having me on your show.
I'll be right back. It's the Savage Nation.
Savage.
Most normal people are in Spain. They're somewhere. Everybody's somewhere. I don't know. Everyone's on vacation but me. I'm the only one who won't go on vacation. I refuse. Now, don't assume I'm just some grumpy old guy. I mean, I have been in many, many places, some exotic, some pedestrian. I don't get the charge out of travel that most people do, yet I understand the need for travel, to be the idea of going somewhere, you know, to feel like you've, you know, left your regular day behind. But, you know, when you're in the media and you live on the edge, as we do, if you're doing the right thing here, traveling doesn't do the same thing that it used to do. I mean, you need it if you have a kind of humdrum life. I don't understand it as much. Maybe when I was young, exotic. Well, what's there? But even the world, 30 years ago, there were differences. You go to Spain, you'd see women walking around in black. Now you go there, you see women looking like the same that you see here. Let's be specific. The same clothing everywhere. It's one homogenous blur, the entire world. The one homogenous Western blob has descended upon the world from here to Manchuria. The same thing, everyone wanting to look like a child at Disneyland. So what's the excitement? You trek to Mongolia and see Mongolians wearing the same, the crack outfits that they wear in the streets of a ghetto here, with the same, you know, haircuts. So who needs it? I'd rather stay here, whatever. So yesterday I got bored because of that, and I realized that, you know, happiness is within. The kingdom of God is within. It's not out there. I don't have to go to Jerusalem to find God, so to speak. So, you know, it was written years ago, the kingdom of God is within, and the kingdom of happiness is within you also. So I said, you know, you got to make yourself interested in life. Life isn't going to come to you and make you interested, so stop it already. You've been there and you've done this. You've gone in circles. Stop with the boredom talk. I had to whip myself into action. It's like one of those doldrum times, you know, where like I'm becalmed on the sea, the high sea of life in that sense. Because success is a stale finale. I got to admit it to you. I'm not boasting. Eugene O'Neill wrote that. It's 100% true. The years I was struggling were more interesting in a way than these years. And I'm not begging fate to suddenly cast me down again. But the point I'm saying is success is a stale finale. There's no question about it. Eugene O'Neill wrote that success is a stale finale, as I just said. The struggle is the success. And when you cease to have a reason to struggle, believe me, nature hates a void. Nature abhors a vacuum, as it's been said. And she'll fill that vacuum with something for you to struggle with, whether it be a nice cancer maybe, a little brain tumor, whatever. Go ahead, keep complaining, and you'll have a nice little reward, I say to myself, because I am, man, I look up. I mean, I know that he's up there looking down, and I know you're going to start asking for too much, you know what you get, a good kick in the behind. So I said to myself, all right, stop it already. You love art. So I go to Bonham's Auction Gallery. Lucky for me, it was a gloomy Sunday in San Francisco, and the Bonhams Auction Gallery is coming up with an auction of Western paintings. Now, I don't mean European art. I mean fine paintings of the West, whether it be Indians or cowboy, just really good, really high-end. I'm not talking Dreck art. We're not talking John Nagy. I look online, and I go through maybe 150 paintings, and I found about six that really look good. So, okay, we pack the whole group into the car, dogs and all. We trek over to the homeless encampment down south of Market, near South Van Ness. We pass the shopping cart folks, and we go into the auction gallery. It was a very nice experience. I felt transformed back to my early years of enjoying art and being in my father's antique store and going to museums. And I looked at the paintings very, very closely. They looked better than they did in the catalog, the online catalog, incidentally. Five of the six did. There was one that struck me as particularly amazing, and it showed a group of, I forget which Indian tribe, you'll have to forgive me, I don't remember which one. It shows them making camp after the first snowfall, where the commentary about it is, it's the first snowfall in the West, you know, some Western range, and this tribe of amazing Native Americans are going out on a hunt after the first snowfall, and they say that the hunt will be very easy because the animal's tracks will be highly visible in that first snowfall. And I think it's called a smokeless fire. These people were such geniuses, the Native Americans, that they could build a fire in the snow with a little lean-to, a smokeless fire. And I'm the kind of guy where I could stare at a painting and get so sucked into it that I'm in there with them, and I'm saying, my God, 20,000 years of living on this continent, and these people not only could live off the land, they had a civilization to go with it. They weren't just simply primitives, you know, grunting. They had a real civilization. A language of their own, a culture of their own, rituals of their own. Astoundingly beautiful, but this isn't the first time I've come to that. I wrote a book in 1972 called Earth Medicine, Earth Foods, Native American Remedies, etc. So I've long been an admirer of Native American culture, to be frank with you. This isn't the first. But it's a great painting. It brings you back to the reality of what we're living and how lucky we really are, how lazy we all really are, and how incapable we really are of living on our own, unless you're the rare guy who knows how to hunt and trap and things of that nature. And I don't know how many of them are left. Don't call me if you are. I appreciate that, you know, that many of you do know how to do it. So here we are, and that's the end of that. And here we are, and I had a bad Chinese meal, overate, almost had the stomach. Oh, that's what I was going to tell you. So I'm in the place, they're looking at the paintings. Now I wanted to tell you the point of the story. So there's a showcase on the way out with, like, memorabilia, like letters, you know, from the artists. And one of the, I had to tell the audience this, I knew it. I look in the showcase, and it's a letter from 1924 from the artist, one of the famous Western artists, to the client who had purchased a painting for, I don't know, $75 at the time. And the artist writes a beautiful letter in beautiful handwriting, unlike today where they have hieroglyphics, they text, they can't even write their name. He writes a gorgeous letter in blue ink to the buyer. And he said, enclosed is the bill. And I wanted to make this as beautiful as the painting. And so herewith is the enclosed. And he did a painting on the letter, on the bill, to the buyer. So I'm staring at this saying, why, my God, what a world this was of civility. And there were a group of gay men in the place. And we had a nice conversation. They loved my dog. And there was a different kind of group than you see the rabble here in San Francisco.
This is the Savage Nation. With God's will and your listenership, I shall return.
Savage.